Hi folks, welcome to episode 10 of the Epochs of the Lotus Eaters, where myself and Beau are going to be talking this week about Charles Martel, Charles the Hammer, and the famous, or should I say infamous, Battle of Tours, and what we think happened, judging by the historical sources, and then of course the modern revisionism, which is really annoying, but it's worth talking about. So, where to begin with Charles Martel?
Well, we could either start with his story, or I thought it might be better to, before we jump in there, to talk about the other side, what was going on with the Muslim hordes in that period.
Okay, So I guess the best place to start is like the time period, right? So this happens in the middle of the 8th century, it's roughly about there. So we're about, what, 300 years after the fall of Rome, 200 years, something like that?
Of the Western Roman world, yeah, that's right.
And so the Germanic tribes have set up their various kingdoms across Western Europe, and these aren't very advanced, of course, they're very primitive. This period of time, they think that many of the Roman ruins are built by giants, and they don't remember. There's a huge amount of historical knowledge and cultural knowledge has been lost. But they're building their own kingdoms, and they're starting to come out of the Dark Ages, although this is right in the middle of a period that is generally considered to be the Dark Ages, so it's not looking great there. But that's like the cold, damp area of northwestern Europe. Meanwhile, in the east, the Byzantine, or the Eastern Roman Empire, and the Sassanids have been fighting for generation upon generation upon generation. They've become old and exhausted empires, and the Arabs have discovered a new faith under a one prophet Muhammad. And he set up an empire, he died, then his successors took over, and then they exploded out of Arabia, thrashing the Iranian Sassanids, thrashing the Byzantines as well, but not fully conquering them, and essentially being driven off, and then going across North Africa all the way to Spain. And having conquered Spain, they find themselves arriving in France, or what will become France, like Francia.
Yeah.
And at the same time, they're advancing all the way past towards India, and they apparently fought a battle with the Chinese at some point.
So it's a bit later.
You can't really understate just the vastness of the Muslim Empire at this point. Yeah. And its youth as well. It's only, 100 years old. So it's a massive, massive empire with professional armies, you know, raiding, conquering, and converting. And it is done at the sword.
Yeah. I think the year 632 is given for the death of Muhammad.
Yeah.
And then his followers, the Khalifa, which is where you get the caliphate and caliphs from. Yeah. It's just an extraordinary explosion. They take over nearly all of Arabia very, very, very quickly, within a few years, very few years. And then from that, historians say there's really sort of two big explosions in the first 100 years after the death of Muhammad. One is immediately, and they take the Levant and big chunks of the Sassanid Persian. Were they Zoroastrians?
Yep.
But of course they become Islamic, they take lots of Byzantine lands, and even though they try to take Constantinople itself, they fail. Everyone knows they eventually do in the 1450s, but that's like 700, nearly 800 years later.
Yeah.
But they try really hard in this period, a couple of times, really hard.
Yeah, there's multiple sieges of Constantinople with hundreds of thousands of Arab soldiers there trying to take it.
Yeah.
And the Eastern Romans have to rely on the Bulgars at one point to save them.
And the Greek fire. In Gibbon, you've got a good few pages talking about Greek fire, what it might actually have been.
Yeah.
But that's maybe another story.
It is.
There's one time, the first time they try and take Constantinople. This is almost very soon after the death of Muhammad. They camp outside for like 6 years,
yeah,
and like lose 30,000 guys, yeah, and in the end have to just retreat because it's just not possible at that point. But also, they take the Egypt and all of North Africa, you know, including what was Carthage and everything. Yeah, yeah. So it's
they take Sicily, they ravage parts of Italy. So they take to the sea very, very quickly, in fact, don't they? And they start, sailing out, ravaging the islands and things like this. And it's all, it's quite a shocking assault on what was previously a fairly well-established world, because people have got to remember that, for hundreds of years under the Roman Empire, essentially nothing happened in many of these places. Nothing happened in Tunisia of any note, but, since like the fall of Carthage till, long past the fall of the Western Roman Empire, nothing happened in Spain during this period of time. And so then suddenly, the fall of the Western Roman Empire happens, and then, stuff's happening. And then you've got another couple of hundred years of nothing happening, of any particular particular note from a geopolitical position. And I mean, this is why I think that the Visigoths just collapsed. In fact, the entire North African, there was a Vandal kingdom as well, wasn't there?
Yeah, Vandals in North Africa and the Visigoths in Spain, in Iberia, really.
Yeah, they just collapsed on almost first contact with the Muslims, because who have they fought? What have they done? You know, they've just been engaging and enjoying their conquest.
I think it is fair to say some have cast doubt over the histories, whether the Islamic expansions were as impressive as they first seem. But I don't think there's any way you can deny that it's on a scale of sort of the Mongolian Empire the ancient Roman Empire, the classical Roman Empire. It's that big, you know, stretching from sort of the Indus Valley, all the way to Spain.
Yeah.
So that is huge. And as I said, there's sort of two kind of explosions, and the second one is when they expand up into Spain, and this later been called Al-Andalus. Yep. People will have heard of that, I suppose. And at the extremes, they go up past the Pyrenees, and that's where you're sort of really getting into the heart of Dark Ages Christian Europe. Maybe that we could just talk a bit about that, explain that briefly. John, we've got the picture of a map of what is today we call France, but there was no France. There was no such thing as France at this point. One thing you did say a minute ago, which is interesting, is we are in the Dark Ages.
Yeah.
And you can find historians or documentaries saying that's a very old-fashioned term, we don't like to use that anymore, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
But it's kind of nonsense. It is a Dark Age in the sense that there's relatively little primary evidence for things, very little literary evidence. And so it's dark in that sense.
Yeah, it's not a literal dimming of the sun or something. the historical record is difficult to pass because there's very little written evidence, as you say. So so this is what it looked like. So we've got the essential boundaries are basically the sort of the what was initially the Frankish kingdom.
Yeah, so these are, again, depending on which historian you want to believe or read, they will sort of describe it differently. But I think what it is that Austrasia there, which is where Charles Martel, that's where his family comes from, their seat, first and foremost, is in Austrasia. But I've heard it said that the Burgundy, Austrasia, and how do you pronounce what becomes Normandy?
Neustria.
Neustria, yeah. That they're really the three most powerful, and that the many of the other proto-states, if you want to call them that, at least after a certain point, become kind of playthings or puppets for the three biggest. They're the three most powerful. So if we want to start on the actual career of Charles the Hammer.
Well, I mean, I think it's worth noting that these are all like the product of Frankish royal lines and various other Germanic royal lines, aren't they? So they end up getting like partitioned between sons on deaths and things like that, don't they? So it's you can't really call it necessarily like an empire, although it essentially is an empire. There's a kind of giant civilization that has formed across what is modern France and Germany, right?
Yeah, I mean, all of it becomes a lot clearer, or it's easier for historians and fans of history to make sense of it after Charlemagne, who is Charles Martel's grandson.
Yes.
So from that point onwards, things become a bit easier to understand. But in this period, it is kind of messy, and because we're in the Dark Ages, we just don't have all the evidence to make it all nice and neat. But certainly Austrasia is among, if not sort of the most powerful. They fight each other intermittently.
But by the time of Charles Martel, it seems that like essentially most of what is modern France and Germany is under the Frankish dominion.
Or it's the Merovingians. So people may have heard of sort of the Merovingian dynasties and then the Carolingian dynasties. So the some have said that the Carolingian dynasty kind of starts with Charles Martel's son
Pepin.
Carloman. He had more than one son. But yeah, that's another thing worth saying about is that primogeniture, the idea that the oldest son gets everything, that's not established at all. Not at all at this point. I mean, even Charlemagne famously had to, or decided to, split his empire up between his various sons.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, a few generations after this. So we're nowhere near primogeniture. We're nowhere near the point where one person inherits everything.
The eldest son gets everything, yeah.
Yeah, so...
And, but this is a tremendously weakening force for Europe itself as a political entity, isn't
right.
it? You know, 'cause, yeah. I mean, if you've got three sons, you've got to carve up Europe among three sons, then suddenly you've got three... smaller and competing states. That
that's the thing. They're competing then, so it's just a cycle
exactly.
of that.
So yeah, anyway. So, right, so Charles Martel is he's what, a nobleman?
Yes,
he's
well...
He's not so, royal, is he?
Yeah, so that's the key, that's one of the key things, one of the things that people know about the Merovingians is that you had a king that was sort of nominally the king, well, he was certainly legally the king, but real power lay in the hands of their sort of leading ministers, prime ministers, what they call the mayor of the palace.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.